Jesus, I would like to come in and read the Word of God. Now look, if you are on your way to heaven, and I am on the way to hell, what is this to you?
Wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schneid is brilliant and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. That's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Schmeed, and what do we have for you today? Time to make a decision of which Gene Shepherd to hear. You want to hear about his house on Cleveland Street, or do you want to hear about, what's the other one called? The one that I just speed corrected because it was slow as all get out, and now we could actually fit it in. Hey, I think we're going to hear the 1962 episode about the house on Cleveland Street. That's what we're going to be doing. From August 2nd, 1962, from the Gary Hines collection. I'm going to hear about the house on Cleveland Street, accumulators, basement furnace, and the old man to finish the attic. Lost, Gene Shepherd, unavailable anywhere but right here in the dustbin of history, WBAI, New York.
Yeah, it's time, you know, and, well, actually, it isn't time. It isn't time at all. It might not ever be time, and that's what bothers me more than anything else. It, might not have arrived. But then, on the other hand, I'm sure that it will. I'm sure that it's bound to happen. I'm sure that something's going to happen. And I'm sure that it's going to work out okay. I'm sure. Like I read this little item that came out of Morristown, New Jersey. The Morristown police put the collar on this guy. You've probably heard of Herman Aschenbach. 72, what happened to Herman? Well, the police put the finger on him. He was sleeping on a park bench Thursday, a week ago. They just came up and, you know, knocked him on the bottom of the foot and said, "You're asleep on the park bench, vagrancy, get up, old man." Well, old Herman got up and they took him down to headquarters. And, of course, the first thing they do down at headquarters is to check in all your personal belongings, you know? Like they take your wallet and, you know, if you got a switchblade or something, they take it out. And if you got a can of snuff or anything, you know, just personal belongings, little things like that, or VAR or something that you carry around for keepsake, your souvenir. A lot of guys carry souvenirs. And anyway, they check in all your stuff. Well, they checked in all Herman's stuff. And this is what they snagged out of Herman's pockets. 5 can openers. Herman's 72, remember, and he was asleep on a park bench. A baby pacifier. A mascara kit. A compass. Now, I can understand old Herman wanting a compass. You know, when you reach the age of 72 and it still hasn't happened, by George, you got to find out something about something. 3 handkerchiefs. 2 balloons. A lady's pin. A fork. A cap pistol. A golf ball. 3 pennies. 4 hats. A train ticket. 5 spoons. 3 jars of salmon eggs. A fishing reel and fish hooks. A cigarette lighter. A few cigarettes. 2 pipes. A can of lighter fluid. 2 empty wallets. Several matchbooks. A copy of TV Guide. A notebook. 2 ballpoint pens and associated refills. 2 pairs of sunglasses. 1 pair without lenses. A broken transistor radio, a swimsuit, a woman's belt, bolts, nuts, wires, string, buttons, flashlight lens, 7 pencils, flashlight batteries, a toy horse, a road map, 2 address books, 7 pencils, a tobacco pouch, and finally, a groundhog's foot and a groundhog's tail. Hold it. Now, wait a minute. Don't laugh at Herman. And I just say don't laugh because, you see, there has to be something pointed out here very, very clearly and quickly. Are you aware that as of recently, science has been delving into one of the more interesting aspects of human nature that has not yet really truly been recorded, and Herman here happens to be a victim of that part of our nature? Well, there are several types of people who are hung on this problem. One, there is the collector. Don't think for a minute that Herman is a collector. There is the collector. The collector is a person who has empty places that he knows must be filled. This is what a collector is. And he has a terrible desire to fill up all the empty places that he can find. And then there is the string saver type. That's another problem too. That has another name. This is a person who gathers things to him because he has a terrible feeling that he's going to lose things. And the more things he has around him, the more secure he is in this world. He is surrounded by these things, and he must keep things. That's the string saver problem. The collector, of course, the stamp collector is another thing entirely. The stamp and the coin collector, these are people we've discussed. They love to have things classified. These are the classifiers of the world. They like to have things classified, numerical order. Have you noticed almost everybody who has a collection of any kind puts little cards under it? He puts them numerically by size, or he'll put them by year, or he'll put them by type. He's very interested in classification of his surroundings. He's more hung up on that than anything else connected with his collection. If you say to him, "Well, gee, you know, those are very pretty stamps," he will probably agree with you. but his agreement is kind of wan. What he's interested in is in filling in the empty spaces. Like if, say, he needs all the stamps of a certain type of a certain set in 1937. This is the empty space problem. You follow me here? That's what he's interested in. He has to fill in the empty spaces. Now, there is another kind of a problem that we have, and that's the accumulator problem. The accumulator problem. The accumulator man is a man of almost unbelievable guilt feelings. This is a person who has terrible feelings of guilt of all kinds. And the accumulation of things, ranging all the way from groundhog tails to hats and compasses and TV guides, fills somehow a void which results from throwing something away. If one throws something away, somehow one has done a bad thing, which adds to guilt, which adds to the feeling of inadequacy and the feeling of just plain rottenness. And so, it is interesting to point out that most people have a slight touch of this problem, the accumulator problem. And again, it's not an collector, it's an accumulator. And most accumulators are ashamed of their accumulations. This is an important part of the accumulator's problem. And they always say to themselves, I'm going to clean out the closet Saturday. I'm going to clean out the basement next week. That's what I'm going to do. And either that or there will even, in some cases, this has been known, that the severe accumulation cases. Do you know that there is one case of an accumulator out on the West Coast who had such a terrible guilt problem about accumulating stuff that as each room would get filled up with an accumulation of junk, the room would be walled off by the person. The person had enough money to do it, and she would wall off the room. Just put a wall over the door so you couldn't get in. It was a wall. And then build another room on the other end of the house to live in. Until finally this person had over 45 rooms spread out over a gigantic wooded lot, filled, just packed right up to the brim. Each one of these rooms filled, just completely packed, chock-a-block, full of junk and walled off. Now, of course, that's an extreme accumulator problem. Now, what was she running away from? Speaking of running away, I'm in a cab the other night, and I'm just sitting in there with a cab driver, see, and this is an associated problem of accumulation. In a sense, Thomas Wolfe had this problem, the writer. He wanted to accumulate, if he could, possibly, every spent instant, every spent millisecond of his life. Every little nuance of feeling, every touch, every flavor, every savor of breeze, wind, and sea. And he tried to put it all together, one gigantic opus, a fantastic magnum. And this was, again, connected with her, you see. The same thing, couldn't stop it, any more than she could stop picking stuff up. Do you know that many of the old ladies who walk up and down, and the old men who walk up and down Lexington picking stuff out of trash baskets, don't need that stuff? They are accumulators who cannot help themselves when they see something thrown away. They've got to pick it up. They just continually piling stuff into bags and walking away and piling it back up into rooms at home. Until finally, of course, they're going to wall something off. People wall it off. I wonder, you know, it's interesting. I remember, did I ever tell you about this wild, great family I knew when I was a kid? You see, the thing about living in a town where houses are separated, and where there is a little vacant space between the areas where people live, is that people then get to know one another. When people live together, they never know one another. It's just the nature of people, that people surround themselves with an absolutely impenetrable wall of privacy the closer they live together. For example, in the Army, you could live with a whole barracks full of guys in the Army and never know the guys on the other end of the building, just 50 feet away from you. You never talk to the guys at the other end of the barracks. Never. 3 years you'd go that way. It's incredible. And yet, living in a home where, say, somebody else is living 75 feet away from you, you're going to talk to them in 3 years. You just have to. And so this is the way it works. We do this. We build this little thing. Well, anyway, there was this life that I was living, you see, when I was a kid. And I lived in houses. Now, you kids might not know what a house is. A house is not a thing that's in a development. I'd like to point this out, too, that that developments, like say out in Jersey, out in Long Island, where you have 450 houses called Bell Manor homes, you know, that kind of thing. These are not houses. These are merely apartments, New York apartments, that have been placed on the ground. They have the same feeling, they have the same attitude, they look the same inside, they feel the same, they got the same hi-fi running, and they have the same attitude, the same people are living in them, because these are apartment people who have somehow felt, and we use the great all-American quote, yeah, well, it's good for the kids, Charlie. They somehow felt that it's good for the kids to get them to move their apartment from Manhattan to Queens somewhere. Well, now there's the same apartment out there. Now, the difference between a house like this, a home like this, or a thing like this, I guess we have to think of a new term for those places. Units. Family units. I guess have you noticed sometimes now they do call them units? So we'll call it a unit, you know. It's interesting how closely related the word unit is with the word eunuch. But nevertheless, just in pronunciation, if not in root. But nevertheless, here is the family unit, you see. It's existing out there. It lives in a house that looks just like all the other houses in this row and all the other houses behind it in this row. And all the people pretty much are the same anyway. Because after all, we are products of a standardization technique. We're products of a standardization world and a standard mechanization. Because if we weren't, you see, we could not fit on the cards. It would be hard to put a person from the 19th century on an IBM card. Very difficult. And so I suspect today we are engineered to fit the cards rather than the cards engineered to fit us. It's a very different problem there, a very different attitude. But nevertheless, I want to explain to you kids, this is an explanation by way of real education, that I lived in what was called a house. Now, a house was a thing which I guess does not exist much anymore, in that it didn't look like any other thing in the block. It was completely different. Now, I'll tell you how our house looked. The house I lived in at this point was the guy who built this house. No one, you know, we didn't know about this. We had gotten this house long after it was built. But the guy who built the house had a thing on porches. So it had a big porch out in front that was about half the size of the average family unit today, in which people live, the entire family exists out on Long Island. It's a great big porch, you see. Tremendous porch. The porch was about, you saw houses like that. Now this was not a big Victorian house. This was just a wooden house, but it had a big porch sticking out in front. Now the porch, I'd say it was the whole width of the house, which was, I would say probably 40 feet wide. And the width of the porch was possibly 15 feet. The porch was that wide. And it was made out of wood, and it had a wooden railing all the way around it, and was surrounded by screens. Now, you see, the porch then became a sort of world in itself, kid. You understand? It was an unclassifiable room. It was a room in which fistfights occurred. It was a room upon which and in which wild things having to do with the discovery of life and all the other things that have to do with life occurred on long summer evenings on the porch swing. Many things happen on porches, which will never happen today because they do not have porches. Breezeways are not the same, kid. Not at all. There was a certain amount of total escape on a porch that had nothing to do with a breeze or even the breezeway. Now, you got the picture, you see, kid. Now, you won't believe this, kid, under this house there was a cave. Now, this cave was called the basement. See, that's something, speaking of caves, this is WORAM and FM New York, Stygian. We've got plenty of stalactites still working here, boy. I'm not kidding. And I'm not going to name names, Mr. Leader, but you know who they are, and I don't know where the charity begins, Dad, or where it's going to end. That's all I got to say. All right, George, and if the shoe fits, it fits. Ow. Pretty terrible shoes fitting on my foot here. All right, you see, underneath this house, there was this cave. Now, this cave was called the basement, kid, and it was dark. Great. I can't describe you, kid. This was before they discovered the playroom complex, you know, the rumpus room jazz. Did I ever tell you about the time the rumpus actually broke out in Anderson's rumpus room and four squad cars arrived, and finally they had to call a fire wagon, and they were squirting water into the basement to cool down the rumpus in Anderson's rumpus room? There was the first rumpus room in our neighborhood, and it actually worked. Oh, what a rumpus. Oh, boy. Boy, let House Beautiful get a hold of that one. the time the rumpus broke out in the sociables house. Two sociables today appeared in divorce court. They took a Pepsi break. Well, we're on the subject of here, the basement. You see, there, the basement is called, it's a basement, kid. Now, the word comes from base. You know what is it, a base? Something upon which things are set. Now, most modern homes don't have basements, kid. So naturally, the base is pretty well lacking. There isn't a true base. Well, the basement had a function, kid. Much more than to have the furnace in it. Now, I have to tell you what the furnace is. You want to know what a furnace is, kid? The furnace was closely related to hell. I tell you, one of the reasons why many of the kids who grew up living in a house that had a furnace in it, many of the reasons why these kids grew up with a deep sense of morality was because they had hell right below their feet most of the time. It was right down there, you know, and you could hear swearing and yelling at 4 o'clock in the morning when your old man's down there trying to get the clinkers out. And you knew there was some, and you'd open up that door and whoosh. And boy, those smoke and the flames would come shooting out, and you knew that you got scared when they talk about the fiery furnace. It was real, wasn't it, Ed? When somebody said you're going to burn in a fiery furnace, you could actually see the grates in your mind. And you could hear some gigantic devil, some enormous, terrible supernatural being has got a crank, and he's cranking on the grates. And here you are, dancing on those grates. Down with the clinkers you go. Boom. So kids grew up with a natural sense of evil and hell. Now, there's nothing you can do when they come and they pour the, you know, I mean, I know most kids live in houses now. They are completely heated by gas or by oil. You never see the gas. You never see the gas, kid. You don't know what the gas is like. You never see the oil. They come and they squirt it into the pavement out there in front. You never see that. And the flame, you don't even see the flame in the ovens hardly today. Well, did I ever tell you about the time my Aunt Min got all of her sideburns? She got her eyebrows and her eyelashes completely blown off. The time she made a set of Parker House muffins in her oven where the whole bridge party was there, and I was there. She reached in the bottom, opened up the poof. Aunt Min didn't stop. She was dummy, by the way, during that game of bridge. And when it happened, she lost her eyebrows and her eyelashes and didn't miss a hand. Came right back and dealt the next hand. Boy, I'll tell you, talk about guts. Well, that's all part of living there. You know, hell is right underneath your feet. Now, on the other hand, kid, above this apartment that we lived in, see, you have to separate the apartment where people live from the rest of the house. Above it was a dank, strange cubicle of terrible mystery. This was known as the unfinished attic. This, by the way, was also a definite source of terrible anxieties because in every house, there was a father, known generically in those days as the old man. In every house, there was this old man who claimed one day on his vacation, he was going to finish off the unfinished attic and make it into another room, which he rarely, if ever, did. And so there was another, it's like, that was the unfinished novel of another age, hippies. That's the truth. And once in a while, the old man would go out and he would buy some nails. Just like once in a while, you know, you go out and put another ribbon in your typewriter, you know, kid, or you buy some more paper, or you sit down once in a while, you sharpen your pencils and you start to write a little bit. Well, that's what they do. Once in a while, the old man, when he was really feeling, really, when the nip of time was on him, you know, when he really felt like he was getting old and things were not happening and he's sitting on his, you know, just sitting there and he'd feel little things biting around the bottom, he'd jump up and say, "All right, clear the way. I'm going up and finish the attic." And he would say, "Everybody be quiet now for the next 4 hours. Stay out of my way. I'm going up and finish the attic." And then you'd hear a lot of, "Oh, you know how you got up in this attic, kid? I want to tell you, it didn't have stairways going up into it, you know." This is what made it even better, kid. Tell you how it worked. In the hall leading to the john, off of the closet, there was, if you looked up not near the top of, "Don't worry, Ted. I'll take care of it, Ted. Don't worry." If you went into the closet, in through the hall, up in the ceiling there, there was a big piece of wood. You got it? It looked like a trapdoor. And by the way, all kids were very familiar with trapdoors, having read a great deal of Fu Manchu dealt heavily with trapdoors. I mean, we all knew about trapdoors. Well, up in the ceiling there was this door. Now, if you got up on a couple of chairs, and you put a box on top of the chair, and you pushed, you would move this big piece of wood back, and you could stick your head up into this dank, strange, scary place that was the unfinished attic. You got it, kid? You can't imagine that, can you? Well, the old man would holler, "Out of my way! And then you hear the door, and he'd be down in the basement. Where's my hammer, for crying out loud? And then my mother would say, well, where did you put it last? What do you mean, where did I put it last? It's not here. She'd say, now just think, where is it supposed to be? What do you mean, where's my hammer? It's not here. Would you please look back of the coal bin on the wall where you put the nails in, where you hang it? That's where it's supposed to be, stupid.
Oh.
And then there would be another period of silence, and they would hear,
what did I pay for crying? Did that kid use that tar paper? Gene, did you take that roll of tar paper that I had under the door bench?
And then, of course, I get sick. Terrible. Of course I took the tar paper. The tar paper is out in the cave back of Flick's house. By that, by the third time he has yelled, I'm out playing second base two blocks away. Well, anyway, all the decks are cleared, see? And 30 seconds later, you hear the old man climbing up into the place. You see, he's climbing up. He pushes the box back. He gets everything. He pulls himself up. And this is a terrible moment because you see, what he really was doing, kid, he was not concerned with fixing this thing that he was thinking of. He was running away from his failure. He was running away from the collapse of his own life. He was running away from time. He knew that time was nipping at his heels. And here he was, knee-deep, reading the Chicago Tribune, watching the football game every Saturday afternoon, listening to the radio, doing nothing. He's not writing the novel. He wants to leave this behind, and he knows it. So the frenzy is upon him. The terrible frenzy. And, kid, you don't know quite about this yet, but once in a while, if you look at your old man close, and you can't figure out why he's frenzied, this is it. It's the frenzy of the realization, and that's caps. The realization that all those little lines in the graph are coming together, and one day it's old Fred, him, that they're going to be singing over. Now, he will never say this. And all the while, the time is ticking away. So he jumps up from his chair, he rushes up, and he's got to finish the attic. I'm going to finish the attic now. And then you hear, pow, 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 a couple of bangs in the house. Hey, Jane, will you get the light from the bottom drawer? The bottom drawer under the sink. Get the light with the extension, will ya? Quick. Hurry up. Pow, pow, pow. And, of course, I'm down there now looking for the light with the extension. And 5 minutes of scrubbing and grabbing through the cheesecloth and the sponges and the pails and junk, I come up with the light with the extension. And I rush over, and I hand it up to him. And he reaches down. You see dirt and crud and his terrible, terrible staring eyes looking out of the darkness. He reaches. Hurry up. Plug it in, will ya? And so I go over and I plug it in, and then there's a dead silence. He said, plug it in! I say, I have plugged it in! Then you hear clicking of the switch. Plug it in! Turn the plug around, will ya? Another switching plug. And then all of a sudden, pow! He said, what happened? What'd you do with the plug? He has blown a fuse. 30 seconds later, the old man is down in the basement with the frenzy upon him. He is changing fuses. Now he is back up in the ceiling again. And this time, he's got the thing working. He has fixed the plug. He is up there now, and the light is hanging from the ceiling. Pow, 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 pow. Hey, Gene, will you go next door to Mr. Boner's and see if you can get some tar paper left, will you? And see if he's got any finishing nails. What? Finishing nails, stupid! What? Finishing nails! 5 minutes later, I'm over in Bruner, and Bruner is in a stupor. He is drunker than a coot. Mrs. Bruner is yelling at Junior, and I am down in the basement with Mr. Bruner looking through his poor, sad, tired, oh, so sad, tired workbench, looking for his finishing nails. And he says, I know where there's some here. Oh, look in the coffee can. And I'm looking in the coffee cans with the nuts and the bolts, and I'm pulling out a lot of little nails until finally I got a handful of sad, bent, little rusty nails and tacks and stuff. It's all, where's it? I guess that's where I got. That's somewhere around here. And 5 minutes later, I'm running out of the basement, out across the yard, up into the house, down through the thing, up, and then I'm standing under that great big dark maw, and I hear up there pounding. Hey, Dad, I got the nails. What? I got the nails. What nails? The finishing nails. Okay, hand them up. And then he looks down, and his eyes are really staring now. They're terrible yellow orbs because time is nipping on them, and the tar paper is not laying right.
and the lathe is not going down right. His saw is rusty. It's not cutting right. The nails are bending. He knows that he's going to die. He knows it's going to happen. He's pounding away there. And all the while, you can hear that hammer going. I say, here, take this, Dad. And he says, okay. I reach up, and I hand him this little sad pile of nails. He says, what do you mean finishing? These are tacks. I said, finishing nails, you know, without the heads. I said, well, that's all Mr. Bruner's got. Oh, for crying out loud. He throws the tacks down, and then he goes back into that darkness, pounds, and then I leave.
I leave. Because this has happened many times before. And I can hear the pounding and the yelling as I go out the front door. I walk past Bruner's house. I walk past Anderson's house. I walk past Thompson's house. I'm going down to Schwartz's house, and I can hear the yelling and hollering even as I go. And I can see he has opened the attic window, which is up near the very peak of this house, kid. It's a little tiny window that's not used for anything, see? He has opened it up so that there can be a little breath of air, and I can hear the hammers and the banging going on. And I know that 4 hours later when I arrive with stickers all over my pants and with stickers in my thumb and with the terrible hot heat of having chased and hit 400 foul balls that afternoon, when I finally arrive back, the old man will be sitting in the living room. He'll be sitting there surrounded by his newspapers. He'll be listening to the radio. He'll be drinking a beer. And he will not mention, not one thing, not one moment will he mention. He will not say another word about the attic until the next time that terrible frenzy comes down upon him. Till the next time he realizes that the hounds of hell and time are nipping at his hocks and that there's no escaping it. And he's got to get up and finish the attic. He's got to get up and he's got to write the novel. He's got to get up and he's got to paint the picture. And I could still hear him yelling and hollering. And then I get down to Flick's house. And I get down to Schwartz's house. And all four of us are getting down there. We're starting knocking the ball around. And Flick says, what was all the yelling at the house? And I say, the old man's working on the attic. He says, oh. You see, his old man had another one. His old man didn't work on the attic. His old man always ground the valves on the Pontiac. Whenever it began to close on him, he began to rebuild the motor, which he never quite finished, ever. You see, he actually drove a Chevrolet, but the Pontiac was kept in the other half of the garage, and he was eternally rebuilding it. In fact, on the day he died, he bought some valve fluid. Just before the lightning bolt hit him, he knew it was coming. And all up and down the line, New Yorkers everywhere doing the same thing. We got to finish this rotten city before we go. We're pounding and we're hammering and we're drilling. We got to get to Jupiter before the lightning strikes. We got to know how the end of the story comes out before we close that last chapter and the hounds of hell are yipping and those yellow eyes are peering out of the darkness. Scary, isn't it? We're bugged, aren't we? I mean, boy. And you want to hear more about that house, huh? Well, I'll tell you then. The thing about those houses... You see, kid, I want to explain something to you now before we go any further. There has to be something else said to you, kid. That the hounds have not really yet begun to nip at your hocks. So these hounds of which I speak are purely theoretical. And their yellow fangs, their yellow luminescent fangs, are yet to be seen by you. Speaking of yellow luminescent fangs, I can remember one time I'm this kid. Now, you see, kids are all the same as just as people are. Your old man is just as scared as you are. And you know, kid, I'm going to tell you something that's going to surprise the daylights out of you. Do you know that your old man doesn't feel that anybody loves him any more than you do? You know that, kid? Now, he ain't going to admit it, because you see what's happened over the last 7,900 years. He has learned to keep this to himself. And that's called maturation. You see, that's the covering up. The maturing process is a process of learning how to cover up and phony real good. How to pretend like, you know, it's all going to work out okay. That's called maturation. Now, you, kid, you're not so sure yet. But you will learn how to do the same thing. And I'm going to tell you another thing, kid, about your old man. This might bug you, too. Do you know that your old man figures nobody understands him either? Are you aware of that, kid? And I'm going to tell you another thing, kid. This is going to really surprise you. Are you aware that your old man figures that his old lady and his old man didn't love him either? That's really going to bother you, kid. But you got to get awful close to your old man to have him admit that, and he probably won't admit it at all because, you see, he can't admit it to himself. And that's called maturation, too. See, after you hit a certain point, you begin to say, oh, well, I guess the old guy liked me anyway. I guess my mother, you know, and after you get super, you pretend this, you see, because if you don't, you know, it's going to be blow-upsville all the way. Now, you just look at the old man there once with a good solid look, and you will find that he's got a funny look in his eye. He's got that same Holden Caulfield look in the eye, too. You are looking at yourself, kid, 25 years from now. Now go ahead and laugh and say, oh no, I won't be like my old man. Well, I'm going to tell you another secret, kid. Your old man looked at his old man 1,600 years ago and said, I won't turn out like my old man. Well, maybe he didn't, kid, outwardly. Maybe you won't, outwardly. Well, so you got this problem, see. Speaking, I'm this kid. I'm one little side comment here. Before we go any further here, we got a little fun thing. It says, summertime means fun for you and your family. And one of the nicest ways to spend an afternoon or evening this time of the year is to visit the American Shakespeare Festival. That's a lot of fun for the kids, you know, family. Sit there and watch King Lear. I've never seen a spot where they come on with the American Shakespeare Festival, and they're selling Shakespeare like it's Pepsi Cola. You know, it's a fun thing for all the family to do together and sit on the lawn. It says only 90 minutes from New York. It's a lot of fun. Hal Holbrook and Eric Berry in Henry IV, Richard Basehart and Richard II. You know, those are awful fun plays, and you sit around there and you can. I don't know whether you know anything about Richard II, that's kind of a nice. There's a lot of kicks there, and I think all of you sitting around there will just enjoy it. And you bring your lunch, and just picture what you ought to do, kid. I'll tell you, and Ma, and Daddy, and all the rest of you listening. Why don't you just imagine that you're watching Route 66 in costume, and I think you'll enjoy it. Thus far, more than 1 million people have come to the American Shakespeare Festival from all over the country. Don't miss summer's most delightful experience. It would be a sad summer if your most delightful experience is watching a show. But nevertheless, reserve your seats now. Phone Canal, CA6-6047. CA6-6047. I don't know whether Richard II is on hand to answer the phone at this hour, but you ought to try. Ask for Henry IV. That's a good one, too. That's one of the historical series, and you'll kind of like that. Well, you know, kid, I'll tell you, speaking of shows, when I'm this kid, I was going to tell you about this great family. Now, see, the thing about these houses, kid, and This is not nostalgia at all. I'm not attempting to point out any way, shape, or form. This is by way of being a disclaimer that the olden times kid, which was like, say, 2 weeks ago, the olden times are better than the new times. I'm merely telling you that they were there, that they did exist. And whether they were good or bad is totally irrelevant and, as a matter of fact, feckless. Such an argument. I know of no argument that has less facts than that one. That there's no such thing as good times or bad times. There are only times. If you are dying from creeping crud in the old days, they are bad days. If you're dying from creeping crud today, they're bad days. Speaking of creeping crud, have you noticed that no matter where you go, there's a large group of people sitting around in buses with radios hooked into their ears? And they're playing stuff, you know, and they've got this dead, sad look, like they're carved out of cream of wheat, the farina look around the eyes, these people, and you get, and they always have these little cheap portable radios that the batteries are two-thirds gone. You know what happens when your batteries go in a circuit that has that type of amplification? Is it immediately, well, I could tell you about cutoff values and mu and everything of the final tube. You want to know about that? Why it gets bad? Well, see, when your battery drops below a certain point, the whole performance curve of your tube, the little thing in the graph and the chart, and the next thing you know, Well, have you noticed that your radio occasionally sounds like that? Well, I have noticed that all the radios carried by these poor lost souls sound like that. That means that their battery is run down. Now, kid, their battery is run down in more places than in their radio. I don't want to bring that terrible point to you, but I saw this sad picture today of a guy walking along 8th Street. He's a little round-faced guy with a hat right on the top of his head. And he's one of those guys who has sports shirts, you know, that has short sleeves, but the short sleeves are just a little too long. You know that kind of short sleeve, Ed? You know, the kind that hangs just right down by the elbow? I don't know where they get these. There's a specific kind of square that buys that kind of shirt. And his shirt, it bunches up just a little bit too wide around the belt. You know, it hangs out in the back sort of round like that. And his collar is just a little too flat. It lays real flat against his cheekbones or his chest bones there. You know, that kind of sort of sleazy shirt. Well, this little guy, a very harmless little man, this is the first guy to get killed in any war, the first guy to get run over by the first bus that goes across on the inaugural flight across the new George Washington Bridge ramp. You know, he's the guy that is always saying the unidentified man found in river, little man run over by gigantic crane, just leaves three kids in the Bronx. You know that guy you always read about? The guy that hurdles to death when floor collapses in office building. And it says man working in obscure office on 7th floor hurtled to death. He was unidentified. However, it is known from the look on his face that he left four children in Queens. You know this guy? Well, here he is. I saw this man tonight. He is walking along 8th Avenue. And he has his kids with him, all four of them. And strangely enough, I don't know how he arranged this, but it looks like these kids were all born at the same time, yet they were all of different ages. They all looked exactly alike, and yet they all looked different. You know that kind of thing? And his wife looks like a kind of, she looks like a kind of tomato aspic, you know, with a little pimento sticking out of the top. And yeah, she's not a tomato, she's the aspic part of it. And she is walking along amid the kids. And the whole, it's like this little saddle, this little kind of a, I don't know, it's like a little formation next to him. And the kids are running around, you know, they're running around, and the old lady is just sort of plowing ahead, and once in a while she makes movements like towards the kids. Hey, come on, hey, will you stop that? Cut it out. She's got nine arms that just keep going out and swatting kids, you see, sticking out of her back and every place else, and kids like that. And the old man is walking sort of like an escort, a destroyer escort. If you know anything about naval formation, he's kind of working picket. He's working out there. He's off the port bow, you see, and he's just sort of hanging out there all by himself, this little round man who one day will be found underneath the wheels of a bus. He will be dragged for 45 feet because they won't know they hit him at first until people start yelling from the curb, you know. He will be the guy that was pushed off the subway platform on 23rd Street at rush hour. You know the one I'm talking about? They're always in the back. And way in the back in the New York Times, there is always a list, you know, where they have their big obituary page and all the big guys die and they get the writings. Way up at the top, at the upper right-hand corner, it says also who died today. And there's a list of a whole lot of people. There's all kinds of ladies named Isadora Rubin. All sorts of guys named Jonathan Winterbine. All sorts of names all the way on down. Yeah, just all kinds of names. And he is one of those names. And this is him. So he, kid, is walking along there by the curb, and what does he have clutched in his right hand? He has a very large, aggressive, sad, cheap-looking portable radio. And he's got it in his right hand, and his wife is over there reaching, and they're all moving along like a slow convoy moving towards some dark Stygian coast, moving towards some unmentionable, unnameable battle that's taking place on some terrible beach somewhere. And they're moving steadfastly and enigmatically towards it. And the kid, hey, will you cut it out? Come on. Now, Rosie, cut it out. Hey, now, Rosie, Johnny, come over here, will you? Stop that, will you, Freddie? And he's walking along there, and he's got this radio, and it's going, and he's not listening. He doesn't see the kids. He doesn't hear the radio. He's just walking along there. And once in a while, the radio seems to sort of rise in volume. Maybe it's because our attention rises in volume. But it somehow takes over and blankets all of and then the kids, hey, come on, Johnny, will you cut it out? And they're just moving along steadfastly moving, always moving. Kid, this is what is known as the American dream. This is the good life. This is life. It is neither good, it is neither a dream. It is just life and existence. And the way it is, kid, I would say probably, 103% of the population in one way or another lives this dream and lives exactly this existence. And all the while, that radio just keeps going, and those kids keep hollering, and the tomato aspic keeps jiggling, and the buses keep rushing by.
The end of another episode of The Dustbin of History. Did you enjoy the show? Let me know. Drop me a line. I am max@wbai.org. That's my email address, max@wbai.org. We have a Facebook page, The Dustbin of History, which is linked to all my other Facebook pages, the main one being facebook.com/Max Golden Age. Max Golden Age, that's the main page for all doings with this program, as well as our internet programs on Saturday, which I forgot about and now have to rapidly go produce. Oh, boy. Yes, we're whipping our way through a 2012 season and a 2016 season. We have two back-to-back two-hour programs, Saturday morning starting at 11 on Yesterday USA, the Red Network. I think we're about to delve into 1930s Chandu on the first show. Check it out, facebook.com/Max Golden Age. and we'll see you next week. We'll be back next week with another edition. More exploring tomorrow, probably more strange Dr. Weird. More Inner Sanctum and another lost Gene Shepherd episode all next week here in the Dustbin of History. And I'll be here Sunday night, 8 until 10, for the golden age of radio. So you be here with me, won't you? Thanks for listening, and good evening.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal.